Belfast, led by the Reverend Dr. Bert Tosh. Now on Radio 4 FM, our new book of the week, The Last Days of Detroit by Mark Benelli. For more than half a century, Detroit has been the epitome of a failed post-industrial city. Benelli, who grew up in the Detroit suburbs, questions whether the city has a future.
Back when I was a boy, growing up just outside of Detroit, my friends and I beheld any mention of the city in popular culture with a special thrill. We loved how Detroit was deemed terrifying enough to be chosen as the dystopian locale of RoboCop, the science fiction film set in a coyly undated near future, when Detroit had become so dangerous that the outsourcing of law enforcement to an armored, heavily weaponized cyborg would seem a prudent and necessary move. And when the producers of Beverly Hills Cop decided to make the hometown of Eddie Murphy's fish-out-of-water detective our own, because after all, what could be more antipodal to Beverly Hills Rodeo Drive than Detroit's Woodward Avenue? What more alien presence to the Beverly Palms Hotel than a black dude from Detroit in a Mumford High t-shirt? We delighted in that, too. We certainly tested the speakers of our American-made Dodge hatchbacks whenever a Detroit song found itself played on one of the local rock stations. Who would be churlish enough to point out how the lyrics pivoted off the city's reputation for chaos, riotousness, destruction to such a degree, the very titles, Panic in Detroit, Detroit Breakdown, Motor City Madhouse, could be mistaken for headlines from July 1967? Even today, when the plangent opening piano chords of Journey's Don't Stop Believin' blare from a dive bar jukebox, who among us begrudges even this most overplayed of power ballads a respectful, split-second cock of the head, and perhaps even a secret inner smile, all because the protagonist of the song was born and raised in South Detroit? No matter that there wasn't really a neighborhood called South Detroit, or that the person living there wanted so badly to get the hell out, he took a midnight train going anywhere. My parents subscribed to Time magazine, and I can remember excitedly reading a story at the height of the tension between Ronald Reagan and the Soviet Union, detailing the effects of a single nuclear bomb dropped on a major American city. This city, the editors explained, had been chosen entirely at random, but of course, it was Detroit. Still, at 12 years old, I devoured the shout-out as if the city had won some national lottery. The article began, "Say it is late April, a cloudless Thursday evening in Detroit. Assume further that there is no advance warning." Beginning at ground zero of the blast and expanding concentrically, the story proceeded to describe in gruesome detail the fate of Detroit and its residents. If you happened to be watching a baseball game at the old Tiger Stadium, for example, you would immediately go blind. Then you would burst into flame. But, the writer continued unhelpfully, the pain ends quickly. The explosion's blast wave crushes the stands and the spectators into a heap of rubble. Skyscrapers topple. Commuters melt inside their cars. Even Canadians in neighboring Windsor, this I found particularly satisfying, would be fatally pelted with fragments of the Renaissance Center, hurled across the river by 160-mile-per-hour winds. Following the geography of the article to my family's own suburb, I learned that, only a minute after the blast, fires would be already raging and tens of thousands of people dying. Survivors crawl from wrecked homes to see an 8-mile-high mushroom cloud in the distance. But survivors! "See," I pointed out to my little brother, even at that early age displaying the hopeful spirit that all Detroit-area natives learn by necessity to cultivate like a rare breed of flower. "One of us might live."
"I'm mighty proud of a baby like you. No, 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 no."
Detroit used to be the greatest working-class city in the most prosperous country in the world. With the explosion of the auto industry, it had become the Silicon Valley of the Jazz Age, a capitalist dream town of unrivaled innovation and bountiful reward. My family came from Italy, our neighbor from Tennessee. My dad's friends were from Poland, Lebanon, Mexico. All had been drawn to Detroit, if not explicitly for the auto industry. My father sharpened knives and sold restaurant equipment. than because of what the auto industry had come to represent. The cars rolling off the assembly lines existed as tangible manifestations of the American dream. The factories themselves a glimpse of the birth of modernity, in which mass production would beget mass employment, and in turn, mass consumption. Workers eager to claim their share of the unprecedentedly high wages on offer migrated to the city in droves, doubling Detroit's population in a single decade, from 465,000 to nearly a million, making the city, by 1920, the fourth largest in the nation. The Art Deco skyscrapers bursting from the downtown streets like rockets must have seemed like monuments to Fordism's manifest destiny. Everything pointed up. Often, people isolate the 1967 riot as the pivotal Detroit gone wrong moment, after which nothing ever went right. In fact, the auto industry had been in a serious economic slump for at least a decade prior. What the civic unrest, aside from hastening the process, did permanently change was the national storyline about the city. If once Detroit had stood for the purest fulfillment of U.S. industry, it now represented America's most epic urban failure. As John Lee Hooker, who had come north to work on the assembly line at Ford, and later made his name as a blues man in the juke joints of Detroit's Hastings Street, sang in Motor City is Burning, "A hometown burning down to the ground, worse than Vietnam." That, for as long as I can remember, might as well have been the unofficial slogan of the city. Welcome to Detroit. Worser than Vietnam. The story of the city, of its meteoric rise and stunning fall, possesses the sort of narrative arc to which people seem hardwired to respond. It's an almost classically structured tale of humble origins, transcended by entrepreneurial moxie and much diligent toil, all eventually brought low by tragic flaws. Of course, on a basic level of storytelling, people also love tales of Detroit because, well, there's just something inherently pleasing about having one's plot expectations so consistently fulfilled. When the chief of police takes to Facebook to warn Christmas shoppers in Detroit not to carry cash because of the high probability of being mugged, or when, over the course of a single fiery afternoon, 80 homes in the middle of the city go up like trees in an old-growth forest, it does not disrupt the equilibrium of the world. In fact, such events reinforce existing ideas in a way that's perversely reassuring. In January 2009, I returned to Detroit to cover the approaching automobile show, and more broadly, the collapse of the domestic auto industry, for Rolling Stone. My family still lived in the suburb, so even though I'd moved away in 1993, I continued to visit regularly. I arrived on the week of Barack Obama's inauguration, an incautiously hopeful moment, despite the seismic tremors of financial uncertainty. In Detroit, though, all minds were bent wholeheartedly upon questions of basic survival, as the city faced its worst crisis in decades. For Detroit, this was saying something. Where to begin? The most recent mayor, Kwame Kilpatrick, had just begun serving a 3-month jail sentence, having resigned in disgrace following a sex and corruption scandal. Meanwhile, the heads of the big three automakers just weeks earlier had appeared before Congress to publicly grovel for a financial lifeline. The school system remained the worst in the country. Crime had also shot back up. Detroit had the highest murder rate in the country, yet the police department's entire crime lab had been shut down the previous fall after a state audit found egregious levels of systemic error. Though the Devil's Night fires that plagued the city in the 80s had tapered off, Detroit still reported 90,000 fires in 2008, double the number of New York, a city 11 times as populous. Detroit's own population had plummeted from a high of 2 million to 713,000, with an estimated 90,000 buildings left abandoned. Along with the empty skyscrapers and block-long factories fallen into ruin, entire residential streets, once densely populated, resembled fields in rural Arkansas after most of the houses had either burned to the ground or been demolished. Whom you ended up fingering in the drawing room could often say as much about your own biases as about the city itself. But I wasn't really interested in any of that. Detroit as whodunit had been done, ad nauseum. Rather than relitigate the sins of the past, I hope to discover something new about the city. Specifically, what happens to a once great place after it has been used up and discarded? Who sticks around and tries to make things work again? And what sorts of newcomers are drawn to the place for similar reasons? These questions seem particularly pertinent now that Detroit was no longer such a freakish outlier. Cities in Florida and California, in England and the Mediterranean, who knew where next? They'd all woken up to the same problems that had been pummeling Detroit for decades, including, but not limited to, structural bankruptcy, unsustainable city services and public obligations, chronic unemployment, vacant and increasingly worthless real estate, and the disappearance of a workable tax base. Left unchecked, Detroit levels of crime, political instability, and blight would certainly follow. I wanted to think about how Detroiters struggled mightily to solve these problems. Historically, yes, but more importantly, right now. I wasn't alone. In the waning months of the Bush administration, a curious thing happened as Michigan experienced a small but significant uptick in one very specific sector of its tourism economy. Journalists started showing up. It turned out that explaining the origins of the financial crisis in any detail required elaborate definitions of complex and stupefyingly boring financial terms like credit default swap and collateralized debt obligation. But with the potential bankruptcy of General Motors, you had something tangible and wholly understandable to a layperson. We'd all at least ridden in an American car at some point, just as we all possessed opinions on various ways in which they sucked. Even better, Detroit provided the sort of breathtaking visual backdrop that shots of anxious-looking Wall Street floor traders or the exterior of Bernie Madoff's condo simply could not compete with. A visit to the ruins of the old Packard plant or a ghost street of abandoned houses became the financial collapse equivalent. It had taken the worst economic crisis since the Great Depression to do the unthinkable. Detroit had suddenly become trendy. And so we all came. Reporters from Fortune, The Guardian, CNN, The Economist. Artists were also colonizing the city. Could this be a first wave of bohemian gentrification? One young couple from Chicago had bought a home in Detroit for $100. Thanks to a nearly 50% tax incentive being offered by the state, Hollywood film crews also arrived, along with actors like George Clooney and Richard Gere. A glossy French fashion magazine even produced a special Detroit issue, featuring shots of models in ruined industrial backdrops. The magazine cost $20 in the United States, or in local terms, one-fifth of the price of a home in Detroit. We came like pilgrims to witness, to profit from, to somehow influence the story of the century. It might very well turn out to be the story of the last century. The death rattle of the 20th century definition of the American dream. But there could also be another story emerging. The story of the first great post-industrial city of our new century. Who knows? Crazier things have happened in Detroit.
The Last Days of Detroit by Mark Benelli was abridged by Pete Nichols and read by John Schwab. The producer was Karen Rose, and it's a Sweet Talk production for BBC Radio 4. Are you taking on too much? Just can't say no? Well, Woman's Hour will have some thoughts about managing the desire to be nice after the news. But first, a look ahead to File on 4, which this week will be turning its attention to France.
We are the enemy number one.
Does Europe face a new terror threat after military action in Mali?
We have in France a strong, although small, community of radical Islamists who are ready to fight abroad, but they can also have the intention to carry out the jihad in France itself.
With jihadist groups warning of terror attacks against France and its supporters, File on 4 examines the threat both in France and in the UK.
Many fundamentalist Muslims are unhappy in France. If they could, they would migrate to Great Britain or to Canada or to the United States.
File on 4, tomorrow night at 8 o'clock.